This is tape two of Reverend Kelly Smith, Nashville, Tennessee. I guess we're in business again. Yeah. You were going to say something about negotiation with a Nashville businessman.
Yes. And one or two things about this that are particularly interesting to me, and rather one that was particularly startling, sort of. We found out that the southern owners of businesses were, in the final analysis, more easily convinced than the northern owners of businesses.
You mean northern owners in Nashville?
In Nashville, that's right. In our first crack, as you called it, we had six businesses that were opening up. Well, the first to agree to desegregate were southern-owned and operated businesses. We were held up for a full day waiting for New York to agree to open up too, because it was kind of a package thing. We'd agreed that all six would open at the same time and all. Same thing happened in the case of the theaters. Most of the theaters here are owned by a chain in Columbus, Georgia, the Martin chain. But we had one that was owned by somebody in New York. Well, we were able to get the Martin chain to agree before we were able to get the New York people to agree.
How do you interpret this?
I really don't know. I think being absent has something to do with it. Being absentee owners, the fact that they aren't on the scene, the other men are. Also, I think perhaps they have some false notions about things. I don't know. I don't know how else to assess it.
You mean they are misinformed about the Southern Temple? Is that it?
This is very possible.
That the absentee ownership was in Georgia for one of these, that's Deep South, mm-hmm. and they agreed, is that right?
Oh, yes. In fact, the president of the chain chartered a plane and came for a conference, which was held right here in this office. And in the first session, he actually agreed to desegregate. The only thing we had to do was to work out how we were going to do it and include the other theaters and what would be the best way to do it, so forth. So, yes, they came through first, and then they offered their assistance and made kind of a joke out of it. He said, here we are, Georgia white people, trying to convince New Yorkers that they ought to integrate, which is what they did. And, of course, the other theater did come through.
Let me shift a... one more question, please. What about the hotel situation here in Nashville now?
Yes, well, most of your hotels are open to all people here.
Which ones are not at the moment?
Let me see. They are the smaller hotels, and I don't think what they are.
You mean the big ones are open?
The big ones are open. Your main hotels are open and motels.
Has there been any friction in the hotel situation?
Not since we got them open. This was just a year ago. This is one of the most recent things we were able to accomplish. And the hotels were open finally through the Human Relations Committee appointed by the mayor. Mm-hmm. Now, we did have some sleep-ins, some demonstrations there ahead of this.
How were they organized?
The sleep-ins.
What did they actually do?
They went, and they weren't really sleep-ins, they went and had lobby sit-ins and this kind of thing. You would sit in the lobbies there and sometimes get arrested, sometimes not get arrested, but just be seen there, stay there as long as you could.
But once the mayor's committee took action, there was no more problem.
That's right. Part of it is the fact that a significant chunk of your economic power structure is on the committee. A number of bankers. And this is very important, I think a very wise move on the part of the mayor. And so when these fellows agree to go after something, then there's a great deal behind what they say, which these business operators respect.
It's not a lecture from a quote liberal. It's a lecture from pocketbook.
I think this is what really happens, yes. I think so.
Let me ask a more general question, which I encountered first years ago in reading Du Bois. I'll read a brief quote. The Negro group has long been internally divided by dilemma as to whether its striving upward should be aimed at strengthening its inner cultural and group bonds and identity for intrinsic progress and for offensive power against caste, or whether it should lean toward the surrounding American culture. And this is, has many different formulations, of course.
I understand.
But the black Muslimism represents one pole in extreme form, and the other, the people who pass, Negroes who pass and disappear.
Yeah.
But the fear that you encounter sometimes, the loss of all cultural and blood identity if you move toward a cultural acceptance, if you accept the Western culture and all of that. How does this split present itself to you and to people that you're acquainted with?
Well, I think most of the people with whom I am associated, and this also represents my own point of view, believe in becoming a part of America, and not a nation within a nation, not a little cultural island of some kind here, but we want to get into what is called a melting pot. America is called a melting pot. And this is what integration is all about. There are some things, I believe, that have been contributions to our culture which have come from Negroes and which would not have come had it not been for the practice of segregation and all that. I think there are some risks that are involved in integration, in other words, but I think the rewards of integration are worth the risks.
Well, I was thinking about the sense of regret at the possible loss of identity. Now, some Southerners feel that.
Oh, yeah.
That they have a loyalty toward Southernism, whatever that means to this man or that man.
Yeah.
And which is a resistance to Americanism.
Yeah.
As they are torn
in
the same way. As Jews say they are torn, some Jews tell me they are torn the same way. To become American, to enter into a totally integrated society, means the death of some part of the soul. Some Jews.
Yeah. Of course, the situation involving the Jews is very different from ours in that there is a religious matter which is there. But I don't really see any merit for the argument that we ought to retain anything. I simply think whatever it is we have to offer ought to become a part of the whole. And we ought to be melted and let identity be lost as far as in fact, I think this has already happened to a great extent. I think
it's happening.
A little late to stop it, you know, if anybody wanted to.
Let me tell you briefly one thing. At Howard University in early November at the Nonviolence Conference, one of the many speakers was a young girl whose complexion was about like mine.
Mm-hmm.
She was a Phi Beta Kappa. Seeing you've been in all the jails.
Mm-hmm.
And she rose on the platform and said, I have a great joy. I have a discovery to bring you. I am black. Your face is so-and-so and so-and-so, but your hearts are white and your minds are white.
Mm-hmm.
I am black. You've been whitewashed.
Yeah.
And it's brought down the house.
Yeah.
There's the black mystique swept the 150,500 people like a brush fire.
That's just interesting. I was supposed to have attended that conference, but I couldn't make it.
Well, I was surprised by this, sort of wild quality of this response, really.
Yeah.
I thought there'd been more variety. It was universal, of course. The next day is different.
Yeah.
Let me ask you another question as a talking point. This is a quotation from Dr. Kenneth Clark on Dr. King and the Muslim philosophy, as opposed to Muslim philosophy. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability, while black nationalism betrays pathology and instability. A deeper analysis, however, might reveal that there's also an unrealistic, if not pathological, basis to King's doctrine. The natural reaction to injustice is bitterness and resentment. The form which such bitterness takes need not be overtly violent, but the corrosion of the human spirit is inevitable. It would seem, therefore, that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love those who oppress them places an intolerable psychological burden upon them.
Well, of course, it seems to me that Dr. Clark is, and the last part of that quotation, confusing the actual philosophy which King represents with an inadequate expression of that philosophy. I think that perhaps there is something pathological in some of the expressions of this and on the part of some of the individuals who are adherents to this. But now, as far as placing an intolerable psychological burden upon people to love his enemies, well, this, I don't know, I'm not a psychologist.
Why is that Christianity anyway?
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. This is not new at all. The Sermon on the Mount presented this. Jesus Christ started it. Well, I don't know that he started it, but it at least was part of his preaching. Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you. It is not impossible, and I frankly think that it is, and then this is from a layman's point of view, psychology, I think it is psychologically healthy for an individual to do this. Difficult, yes, but I think it is finally healthy. I think the absence of this, the inability to do this, may be a greater psychological burden. Certainly feel it would be a greater spiritual burden.
They can't really be separated, can they?
I don't see how you really can.
The psychological and the spiritual.
Right.
We know a good deal about the white man's stereotype of the Negro. It's been gone into many times. What about the Negro's stereotype of the white man?
Yes.
How do you think, how would you describe that stereotype?
I think part of it is expressed in something we mentioned earlier. That is the feeling that all white people are bad as far as the racial problem is concerned. And there are people who genuinely believe this. They have had some kinds of experiences, or they have observed some things, and they use these experiences to represent everything. They sort of generalize on something that is a particularly specific experience. I don't know. I don't think for the moment how this idea of stereotyping further expresses itself. I know that there are people who think that the attitudes of all white people are alike. There are some who are frank about it and some who disguise it. Of course, I think this is a very false and wrong kind of thing. I used to have a similar feeling. Of course, I grew up in an isolated kind of community because it's all Negro.
Mountain Bayou.
Yes. And I didn't know very much about white people. So whatever I saw of them, I thought that more or less represented all of them. I had this kind of fallacious point of view, too. I remember once when a mob came to our town. This was the first time I had ever seen that many white people, on any occasion at all.
And what was this occasion?
Well, a Negro farmhand had been shot in the foot by his, I started to say, his slave master. That's about what it amounted to, by the plantation owner or boss or somebody. And he returned fire. And while the man only shot him in the foot, he killed him. And he left. And Mounvalla, being all Negro, was considered a rather logical place for a person like that to come. And that had happened. There had been people, and this fellow had been there. He was gone, however. I think he was outside the town somewhere at that time. But a mob came into town with some men of them wore hunting clothes. They had guns, they had ropes, had a rope about this high off the back of a truck, a real large rope, and a barrel of gasoline. All of this, you know, looking for a Negro. It was kind of sport to them, apparently. Well, word reached us at school. I guess I was maybe 12, 13 years old or something. And so coming back through the little town, I saw these people there, and they had one of our, the town doctor at that time, he was the only doctor there, surrounded. They were surrounding him. They were asking him questions, and he was answering the way he wanted to, not the way they wanted to. And when he would give a wrong answer, maybe 8 to 10 men raise their guns like this, and you just know that they're going to fire on him. They never did. In fact, he's still living. He had treated this man, and somebody had told them that the man had been treated by him. And the doctor would not give the facts to the mob, and I don't blame him. I think he's morally justified in that situation. But, these were white people to me. It's the first time I'd seen this many white people. So I developed a rather distorted notion some years before I came to know white persons on a different kind of basis, and to realize how wrong that I was in this. This kind of stereotyping does happen, and I think it's bad in either case.
I was told in Mississippi by several people that there had been various kinds of resentment on the part of Negro students and other Negroes who were working in the civil rights movement, voter registration and so forth, against whites, as well as against Northern Negroes who came in to work in this too. This had been a real problem in Mississippi. Three different people brought this up and told me this, and some of them told the same episodes, but primarily against the younger white people who came in, students and people just out of college or just out of school who came in. A real friction had developed, and real problems had occurred. Mm-hmm. And real possibilities of little bits of violence here.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Have you seen any of that here in Nashville?
Much of it. We have welcomed people who've come in from other communities. I can conceive of problems developing, but I cannot conceive of a problem being so acute that it would mean that we need only ourselves. We don't need meddling outsiders, you see. I think this is just so much brainwashing. I think we have fallen victim to some of this thing, some of the propaganda of the bigots. You see, these meddling outsiders, you know. I was accused of being a northern outsider until I told them that I was from northern Mississippi. It's changed it. But, I just don't... Our experiences haven't led us to feel that there's anything wrong with Northerners coming in and participating. I can conceive of people going off half-cocked who have come from the North and who have a very distorted and false notion of what the real problem is, and maybe of their own importance towards a solution, and to come in and to assume a role that would be harmful. And I'm sure that this can happen, and probably has happened.
Apparently some of that has happened. In some cases, I was told, specifically because well-trained people were moved quietly in to what you might call command posts, not through any will of their own, because they were needed.
Mm-hmm.
And this created friction. Human nature said itself.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
But also involved in this, there was something of the white stereotype.
Yes.
That got mixed up with this special provocation.
Yes, I'm sure this must have been involved in.
There's less of that here, though, and I gather from you than there has been.
Yes, we haven't had much. Now, we have, of course, as anybody might suspect, people who appear to have pink fringe have come in, you know, to take advantage of the situation. Sure. We've tried to be alert to this as nearly as possible. We try to know a little something about the people who would come in, and we have not always judged them correctly. But this hasn't really worried us too much because we think that the authorities, federal authorities, understand the situation.
Of course, it could be used again. In some communities, it would be a very useful weapon for segregationists, however.
Yes. We had one situation here. It just surprised us that it never hit the press, and it never reverberated against us. There were a couple of boys who came in here, a couple of white boys who came in from some place, and got arrested by the police, and the police found communist literature on them in their possession. And they had participated in some demonstrations or something here. Well, that never really hurt us, to my knowledge. I don't quite know why. I think one thing, I think that the federal authorities, and I underscore federal authorities, were aware of what we were doing and aware of some of the problems and this kind of thing. And therefore, there was not too much to worry about, even in a case like that.
Of course, it was exploited, even there was no basis for it in Mississippi.
Oh, yes.
It's been exploited, and the whole front page of a newspaper would be turned over to this notion.
Anybody who is for integration is communist, some people's thinking.
I remember in Hoover's apartment of Judge John Parker of the Supreme Court, was opposed by Negroes, and I read that this is the first successful organized political protest on the part of the Negroes. He was not confirmed in the Senate. The opposition being they were afraid of him as a Southerner. Now, an account of this appears in Walter White's, A Man Called White book. This is 1930. But it appears later that he was a quite impartial judge. Mm-hmm. There'd been a failure to investigate him. And the same with Judge Black.
Yes, yes.
Later on.
Yeah, I remember that case.
Do you think that kind of stereotyping of the Southern white would occur now in Negro policy?
Not as emotionally, no. I don't think so. Questions would be raised, yes. It would be considered an issue and something to be concerned about. But I don't think it would be quite as, I don't think the reactions would be quite as emotional as they were then, because we've learned a good deal about Southern whites. One thing is that they are individuals rather than everybody being of the same disposition and set of values.
Let me switch to another topic just for a moment. Mm-hmm. I see that the whites, the Citizens Council people, are now running ads with quotes from Lincoln.
I saw that yesterday.
Well, long before that, many people have remembered what Lincoln's views were. Lincoln as racist.
Yeah.
Now, this fact of his racist attitude, what does that mean to the Negro now today? Why go to Lincoln's monument if he is a racist?
Mm-hmm.
And the March on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
What problems are inherent in this, just in this simple fact, and what solutions are there for the problems?
Well, I don't know.
I mean emotional problems.
Yes, I think there's a good deal of ambivalence in our attitudes towards Lincoln. Of course, when you consider Lincoln against his Senate, you might find a different kind of thing what you would find if he's pictured against the setting of the present.
That's the question I'm really raising. Mm. How much are certain judgments unhistorical, you see?
Yeah.
And merely some absolute notion outside of history. if you ask, say, a not too informed Negro student this question, you see.
Yeah.
And then say, but Lee was an emancipationist and willingly emancipated long before.
Yeah.
If they, you know, are older and an older student who knows some history, you get one whole body of feeling from the younger person who doesn't know much history, you get another kind of totally unhistorical answer. You get a violent confusion
right.
of feelings out of that. But I don't know what there's no price tag on this question. I just wonder what you would say about this as a question.
Yes. Well, that's one thing that I would try to take into account. The fact of the setting and, well, of course, the whole setting against which Lincoln lived, and then the particular context of specific statements which he made. I would just a quotation from Lincoln would not suggest
it. No, a single quotation is not fair.
That's right. You know, find out what the whole context is and what he was getting at. You know.
As one eminent historian said to me some time back, it'd be almost impossible to find a man in Europe or in America in 1860 who was not a racist.
Yeah, this is what I mean. Kind of thing.
You might have found one, but it'd been very long search getting at it.
Yeah, a rare find.
This question of time in history is coming at now. I'll read you a quote, if I may, just as a starting point. This is from Gordon B. Hancock, Dr. Hancock, you remember. The color question is a social problem, and as such, is not essentially different from any other social problem. And by reason of this fact, it responds to the same processes of adjustment or maladjustment. Social problems, by their very nature, do not lend themselves to instantaneous and absolute solutions. This over against the slogan Freedom Now is two poles of the problem of the Negro movement, the civil rights movement, the Negro revolt.
Mm-hmm.
The two poles of, you know, feeling and discussion.
Mm-hmm.
How can Freedom Now be interpreted in a historical context this way?
Well, Freedom Now, I think, has to be the goal of anybody who is sincere in the struggle. I think it has to be for, I suppose, for strategic reasons. You can't ask for less. Well, let me just give you one example here. Our ministerial association, which is now deceased, the interracial group, I talked with the president, and we got them to agree to ask for a complete desegregation of the schools immediately. He said, well, I don't think this is practical because the people aren't educated up to this, and we could have all kinds of problems. I said, well, I don't know if it's practical or not. Well, this is what we want. Now, what we will get will perhaps be as close to this as the circumstances would seem to warrant. And this to me seems to be the same kind of thing. That
sure it is.
Yeah, you aim at the maximum, you aim at the moon, and try to get it, and get as close to it as one possibly can.
To say it back to you, in other words, I should, I get what you mean, that Freedom Now represents a concept of ideal justice, is that right?
Right.
Which to implement in the imperfect world is subject to, which in implementation of the imperfect world is subject to the pressures of
right.
the occasion.
Right, this is exactly right. This is what I mean. But now Negroes, for the most part, are not satisfied with less. This is something that's been very difficult for whites to understand in communities where we have made some progress.
Yes.
I have had occasion to speak on progress in civil rights or something, and my statement has always fallen on very unsympathetic ears when I say that no amount of progress is satisfactory. because progress suggests process. It suggests a piecemeal kind of thing, and none of that is really satisfactory. What we want is not progress, we want complete freedom. Now, progress is something that gets into the picture in order to get towards this. But we want everything right now. We should go down here and talk to these people. And always I would start, whenever I had the opportunity to start it, I would start the conference by saying, we would like to have your business desegregated by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, since you're closing within a few minutes today. In the morning when you open it, we'd like to have it desegregated. Well, of course, this is impractical. You know we can't do this, and maybe sometime in the distant future it will happen at all. Well, then we try to come somewhere between his distant future and mine tomorrow morning.
Yes. Yeah. Well, negotiating in those terms is one thing. The philosophical view would be quite a different thing of the relationship, wouldn't it?
Yes, I would say
they're
so.
They're not quite the same thing.
I would say that they are different, yes. But I don't think that any ambition for anything less than everything is adequate.
No ambition for less is adequate.
That's right. Now, of course, yes, realization, you will realize that all these things can happen as we want them to.
As one young man said to me in discussing this general topic, he said, I know all about the processes of social change
mm-hmm. Yeah.
for my courses. He said, but I hate to say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is what I mean. Yeah, you know that there's going to have to be process involved, but this you just don't like because it suggests gradualism. It suggests less than the ultimate.
Words get symbolically charged, don't they? So they aren't even useful. That process is a symbol, is a charged
word
right now.
That's true.
Have you had much acquaintance firsthand with the matter of, well, protection of status and advantages within the segregation pattern of Negroes who find themselves in privileged positions inside segregation and therefore resist it in one way or another? The most extreme case I know is an editorial written by the president of the, this isn't the title, but the Negro Business Association of St. Louis. Integration will set Negro business back 25 years.
Yeah.
That argument.
Yeah. Now, here we have had very little of that. We've had people who had certain political advantages because of segregation. We've got all Negro wards and this kind of thing. And you can get elected as long as you have segregated housing, and you probably won't if you don't have it. Our councilmanic elections are by districts rather than as a whole. People nobody is elected at large except the councilmen at large. Others come from districts. So if we didn't have segregation, we have put 5 or 6 Negroes in city council. We wouldn't have that otherwise. But, and we have some, I understand that one hotel man was a Negro hotel owner, was somewhat critical of our efforts to desegregate the hotel. But this is frankly isolated in my experience. We had very little of this.
I know this, one of my friends in New Orleans tells me that the Negro caterers in New Orleans have protested. He said, this is a Negro telling me this, have protested because Negroes are using the desegregated facilities at the Hilton.
Yeah, I see.
This has come to a real showdown between the Caterers Association and the Negro civil rights groups.
Yeah. Of course, the Negro businessman ought to be able to compete with any other business people. He should broaden his clientele. Also, it seems to me that integration has been seen much too much as Negroes wanted to get in something which white people own. This is part of it, but only part of it. As much else too. This is one of the efforts we have here. I'm trying to lead the people into a real integration effort at our church here. Sure, I think that the churches downtown, the other churches downtown, ought to be open to all people, but I think we not only ought to be open, we have to sort of do something aggressive and overt to make known the fact that persons of other ethnic identities would be welcome here.
So it cuts both ways.
That's right. It works both ways, not just getting in. I expect our emphasis has been a little one-sided in that regard. This may be part of the reason that some people are rather disenchanted about the progress that's being made, as a businessman.
Is that true of the future of the Southern College, the Southern Negro College?
I think some.
The segregated college, that's their possibility of a future?
I think for some, yes. But for those that are trying to measure up and just become a college, I think this is a very different sort of thing, a college where young people will want to come regardless of their race. Some will be weeded out.
You mean just not good enough? Or
just not good enough to stand the competition that they will have to face with an open society.
It's rather parallel to the old church colleges and church schools, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is.
I mean, many colleges were church schools and withered away because they couldn't meet the competition.
Yeah.
Some, all were church schools originally.
Yes.
It's just a state university.
This is quite true. Yes,
and they changed their nature.
Yeah.
Became.
This is quite true. And those, the weaker ones will pass. As I said, they are calculated risks. They are risks, and we might as well calculate.
It's very hard to know what will happen to some of the southern state-financed Negro schools.
Very hard. In West Virginia, the state school became, so the Negro school that was a Negro school became, I think there are more whites than Negroes there now.
So I understand they had two or three departments that were better than anything around, that attract the white students in these departments.
So far this has been the exception. Mm-hmm. Rather than the rule, worry about what would finally happen.
Have you noticed any anti-Semitism among Negroes here? It's very strong in some patches, around the country.
I think you have more stereotypes here than genuine anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I think you have actual stereotypes where you say, he's a Jew and he'll do thus and so and thus and so. Because he's a Jew, I don't think it's overt, really, in any large measure at all.
There's been no problem about it anyway.
There hasn't been
on a practical level.
No, we've had to meet with some Jewish merchants and so forth in connection with the same thing.
And they have been as cooperative as anyone else.
Oh yes.
Of course, we all know how this prejudice arose in the Jewish ownership of housing and the corner grocery and usually in big cities.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a creditor, the local creditor.
Yeah.
Or local landlord.
Yeah.
And the stereotype was put around him. Mm-hmm. One more question, if I may. I won't keep you forever.
Sorry.
I've read and seen figures on it, and various sources. The ratio of, well, two things. One, Negro philanthropy to Negroes as being less in relation to their resources than, say, that of Jews to Jews or any other ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
Less giving to their own race in terms of ratio of resources.
Yes.
The second thing, in terms of supporting financially civil rights movements, their ratio has been less than, say, the ratio of Jews on to Anti-Defamation and such. Mm-hmm. Not a question of absolute figures, but a question of ratios. Of
I would suppose that this is true.
You think it varies here, or not? Or do you have any figures on that?
I don't have any figures on it. I've heard many statements about it from people in various walks of life.
How would you account for this?
I don't know. I suppose I find myself becoming kind of an apologist at times. It's a rather easy easy thing to say, well, the circumstances to which Negroes have been subjected would make them cautious and maybe not always even wise and not liberal, maybe conservative with their funds. It's been a struggle. It's no, there are no Negroes for whom money has been in the family for generations, you know, handed down. No Negroes like that.
There have been no Negro Rothschilds.
That's right. This is right, you see. So this generation just got it, the one who has it. You can be sure that he struggled from the bottom up to get it, and this kind of thing. Well, this is a part of what I would say, and I think I'm assuming the role of sort of an apologist, because this probably is not all of it.
Well, is it an apology? It's just a question. That is clearly a question of fact on the fact of the record.
Oh, this is what has happened.
Yes, it's happened.
Whether or not this is the reason, I don't know, but I think it's related. I think it's a part of the
some answer. Sociologists have said this is, in quotes, a psychology of poverty. Mm-hmm. Yet on some of the psychologists have, I mean, sociologists have said, yet you have conspicuous consumption.
Yeah, you
do. It's self-indulgence of a certain kind, which means not the psychology of poverty. That these two impulses are antithetic.
Yeah.
Both can be said to exist at the same time. Do they have a common psychological ground or a common historical ground?
I sort of think so. Mm-hmm. I sort of think the psychology of poverty and conspicuous consumption have come from the same, out of the same soil, actually, and they are, in a sense, trying to do the same thing. I mean, the reactions are trying to do somewhat the same thing. Negroes have been so limited in what we have had and where we could go and all that we have tried to take what was accessible and make it do for what wasn't mm-hmm. accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it could really be done.
Mm-hmm.
Like driving a Cadillac cannot mm-hmm. substitute for first-class citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you want to do something
mm-hmm.
and your actions may not be wise, but you feel like there needs to be some action
mm-hmm.
and you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And churches, see, the church for the Negro has been some of everything.
Yes, and this leads me back to something else. Now, this I won't torture you any further with
this
interview.
Right.
One other question. How much of the nonviolence is secular tactics, and how much do you feel, among, in the range of your acquaintance, is grounded on philosophical or theological basis?
I fear very little on the latter.
Tactic.
It's a tactic. It's a
mm-hmm.
technique,
mm-hmm.
and it's an expedient. It's an expedient kind of thing too. Well, we all have weapons, you know. This is very unfortunate. I was talking with some British newsmen. Yet they weren't really newsmen. They were men who were doing some work in this country, in this area yesterday. And I was saying, as I say now, that I feel a personal guilt for this. In this community, because I don't think that we did the wisest thing in our movement here. I'm a little stopped up. In our workshops, we should have included a little bit more of the.
New one.
Yeah.
Want to use it?
It'll be interesting to hear you explain that on tape.
All right.
Let's see, what was I getting at?
The British newsman. Yeah,
well,
some guilt.
Yeah, I was saying yesterday to them, as I say now, that I feel that in our workshops, in our churches, we should have done more than we did. We should have kept the things that were happening within some kind of a theological frame of reference, which we did not do. I suggested it, but I was not insistent, and I was a leader. So I think some of the things that we did outside the church should have been done from within the church. itself. Of course, I'm using church in the ordinary sense of the term. Technically, we could mean something very different. But we have not seen not only nonviolence, but the struggle itself. Not from a theological vantage point, really.
You know what he says, of course, that the church has missed its big opportunity.
Yes,
many people say that.
I think he is exactly right there. I think he's exactly right.
It's led to the killing of missionaries in the Congo as a result, too.
Yes, which is true. And of course, the church among white people, and this is a very bad thing to have to do, describe the church in this manner, has not done its part. And the leaders in the movement have, for the most part, been ministers or people connected with the church. The church buildings have been the places where you meet and this kind of thing. This church was this. We had to do a lot. The fire department required us to do a lot of things because this church is being used. They never said this, but we recognized what was happening.
Putting pressure on you through this.
Yes. We recognize this. We spent several thousands of dollars for this purpose. But even the involvement of Negroes, of ministers, you know, churches, this involvement has been non-theological for the most part. This is what I'm talking about. This is the thing where I feel guilt because I didn't do my part in leading in this direction. I felt it, mentioned it a couple of times, but never pursued it.
Let me ask one more question. It's really final. On the matter of great number of Negro leaders that have come out of the South, or in the South still. It's been a vast disproportion in terms of population and in terms of education. Mm-hmm. The South has produced much more than its share of leaders at all levels to the movement. It seems strange in the light of the, you might say, the more advanced situation of Northern Negroes in education and everything.
This is the reason, I think. I think it's just the reason. I think I've been wanting somewhere to speak from the subject of dangers of progress. Because I think, for instance, people were more apathetic in Nashville than they were in Montgomery, Alabama.
They were?
Yes. There were some things that we had in Nashville. We were not quite as segregated as it were in Montgomery, you see. And we weren't really as aware of the problems here as they were there. You couldn't miss them. You really couldn't miss them here if your eyes were open. But the people here became involved once the problems were dramatized. They began to see what really happened. In the North, the concept of the problem, I think, is at fault. The concept of what the problem really is.
Can you say how you think that to be true?
Well, I spent a few months in the North. And the people, let me go to this kind of illustration. During the heat of our battle, I was asked, as a representative of this movement, to go to many places in the North to speak. And the people wanted to sit there and sob and hear the horror stories of the South, the things that are happening there. And I went to one community in Ohio where there was a little lady sitting there with about three Negroes in this audience. And one of the little colored ladies wanted to speak on a problem which she had in that community. The chairman did not want to hear about this, you see, because we came to hear Mr. Smith tell us about Nashville. Of course, this is when I told him that I would just end what I had said right there. And let's see what could be done about the local problem. But there is a kind of hypocrisy, I think. There is a kind of false concept of the relationship between people of different races in the North. It is not as dramatic as it is in the South. You don't have signs up and so forth. So people don't really recognize what the problems are. It takes something like what happened in Cleveland the other day to sort of dramatize the fact that you have the same kinds of problems.
Are you referring to Negroes as well as whites in the North? Or
I really am referring to both.
To both?
Yes, to both. Now, we went to Cleveland last year, just a brief period there, and our children were in segregated schools for the first time.
Oh, you had a church there, didn't you, for
yes,
a brief time?
That's
and,
right.
And
returned
life,
here.
Yeah.
That's right. We came back here, a large church there. But there in Cleveland, our children were in segregated schools for the first time. They'd never been in segregated schools in Nashville. Yeah.
Because of their age, you mean?
Their ages haven't been just right,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the integration here. But there were many people who didn't care too much for my saying that in the Cleveland community, in enlightened Cleveland.
This is de facto segregation.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. De facto, and it's symptomatic of other real diseases in human relations which exist.
Well, this has been fine. It's really fine. I appreciate it no end.
Well, it's all right.
I really appreciate it.
Well,
and I'll be sending you... this is the end of tape 2 and the end of the conversation with Reverend Kelly Smith.